Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour, Focus 580, our guest is William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA and author of the book, In Our Own Best Interest, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. The topic of human rights has taken on renewed resonance over the past year as Americans and citizens of the world grapple with the complexities of the war on terrorism and the appropriate response. On the one hand, terrorism is itself a grave violation of human rights, but the terrorists may claim to be responding to injustices committed against them and those they claim as constituents. And as many commentators have pointed out, the measures we take in fighting terrorism may serve to continue the cycle. How can we live up to our claim on the moral high ground? What is the relevance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to this struggle? Or as William Schultz asks and answers in his book, how does defending human rights for all people around the world benefit us? As we talk with William Schultz, you are invited into the conversation. All you need do is pick up the telephone around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We have a toll-free line anywhere else you hear us around the Midwest here, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us email at talk@will.uiuc anytime during our conversation. A little bit more about our guest. William Schultz was appointed Executive Director of Amnesty International USA in 1994 after a lively career as an opponent to the death penalty, as an advocate for women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, and racial justice. He is an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and served for 8 years as the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. He has traveled widely around the world, leading missions in post-revolutionary Romania, India, the Middle East, Liberia, and Northern Ireland, among other places, and he was instrumental in his denomination's opposition to U.S. military aid in El Salvador. He has served on a number of boards, has written and commented widely in the major media, and I guess in his spare time, he authors books, including In Our Own Best Interest, which was recently published in paperback with a new preface by the Beacon Press. There's much more we could say by way of introduction about our guest, but before we run out of time, let's say good morning to William Schultz, who joins us this morning by telephone. Hello.
Good morning, Jack. Good to be with you.
Well, we're very glad to have you.
Thank you.
In your book, which came out in hardcover before 9/11,
that's right.
You write, if large numbers of Americans are ever to care about human rights violations around the world, they must be able to see the implications of those violations for their own lives here at home. Do you think 9/11 did that for us?
Well, I think if we're wise, it did. It certainly did at the beginning, and I hope we haven't lost that sense of our connection with the fates of other people around the world. If you look at something as simple as the fact that the 19 hijackers came from two countries, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, that have two of the worst human rights records in the world and that have largely precluded its citizens, their citizens, from expressing their dissent from government corruption and government repression through democratic means, thus encouraging people like those hijackers to resort to extremist means, I think that's a very good example of how the violation of other people's rights around the world can come back to haunt us here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think also the reaction of Americans was and probably still is somewhat conflicted about how we respond to acts of terrorism and the people responsible and the people who have, you know, perhaps supported those people. You know, on the one hand, we stand for justice and so forth. But I think there's also a reaction of rage and maybe a willingness to overlook in our own response what in many cases would be clearly against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Well, look, there's certainly no question that the events of 9/11 constituted a horrific crime against humanity, and that those who perpetrated them and those who supported that actively should indeed be punished. And there is no reason why military action or police action to take those people into custody and punish them, if it's in the course of military action, they can be killed as well, of course. There's no reason why that in and of itself is inherently a contradiction of human rights. Human rights movement is not a pacifist movement per se. But the problem is that the war on terror is being fought in defense of the rule of law. It's being fought in defense of American freedoms and American values. And indeed, no group of terrorists can possibly succeed in the long run without a much larger group of supporters who may not be actively engaged in terrorism themselves, but who are sympathetic to terrorism or to the terrorists' ends and goals, at least, who support them perhaps financially, at least politically, and from whom they can eventually draw future recruits. And it's those people who are most offended when they see the United States supporting corrupt regimes in the Middle East, when they see the United States itself in its own practices here at home violating some fundamental human rights of due process, for example. And that's why it's dangerous when we ourselves don't abide by that rule of law that we are quite appropriately preaching to the rest of the world in the course of this war on terror. That's why it's so dangerous when we ourselves don't follow human rights principles.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, we had a call off the air. A listener wanted to know if you could talk about people being detained without due process, and they didn't specify whether that's here in the United States or elsewhere, but I think that there had...
Unfortunately, it is at least going on here in the United States, or at least under U.S. auspices. There are several examples of them. We know that post 9/11, about 1,200 people were taken into custody here in the United States. These were almost exclusively people of Middle Eastern or South Asian descent. Some of them were charged with a crime, though not a single one of them was charged with a crime connected with terrorism or 9/11. We don't know exactly how many of them are still being detained. We suspect that it's between 100 and 300 people, largely being detained on various visa violations. Now, that in and of itself is a violation of international human rights standards, because if you take someone into custody for a visa violation, if they violated their visa, you can certainly deport them, but you've got to tell them what their violation is, you've got to provide them legal counsel, and you've got to then process their case in an expeditious fashion. Or if we take, as a second example, those prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay. Again, Amnesty International has no sympathy for those prisoners who were involved in human rights crimes. They can be prosecuted. But the problem is that the United States is holding them in a sort of limbo down there, and contrary to the Geneva Conventions, which require that the status of people taken into custody in the course of military action, that is, whether they are prisoners of war or not, must be determined by an independent tribunal like a U.S. court. And that is something that the administration has thus far refused to do, holding those people in a sort of limbo down there, in a sort of legal limbo, where their fates can't be determined appropriately by a court of law. And the final example I'd give is the two U.S. citizens who are currently being held under custody. They've been labeled enemy combatants, and therefore they've been refused the right that every U.S. citizen deserves, which is the right to counsel, the right to legal counsel, and the right to know what charges are being brought against him or her. And that's clearly a violation of due process and of our own laws and human rights standards.
Yeah. Well, I heard on NPR just, I believe, Friday evening, discussion of this very issue, and I don't remember who the person was who said the statement, but it was to the effect that, well, you know, yeah, it's a shame that people are imprisoned without due process and without representation, et cetera, but if any handful of those hundreds of people were terrorists, then basically it's justified because we may have saved hundreds or thousands of American lives.
Well, what would not be justified then? Would it be justified to torture them? Would it be justified to simply execute them in the prison cell without any kind of trial or any kind of opportunity for them to refute the accusation that they are terrorists? Look, again, neither I nor Amnesty International has any problem with someone who is convicted legitimately of being a terrorist or being involved in a terrorist conspiracy. They should be punished severely. That isn't the point here. The point is that we all know that the way in which you go about determining whether someone is a terrorist or not is by presenting a case and letting them have an opportunity to respond to those charges and to have the benefit of legal counsel. That's just elementary to the entire system of due process that the United States has always stood for around the world. And if we don't do it, then how can we possibly tell the Pakistanis or the Uzbeks or the Russians or any other country that is not inclined, like China is not, for example, to allow due process, how can we criticize any of these other countries? China will just tell us that the people that they are executing without trial are terrorists, too.
We're talking this morning with William Schultz. He's Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. He joins us by telephone, but he will be in Champaign-Urbana this coming Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. And that is an event that is free and open to the public. And so if you'd like to attend, that's where you can do it. And we also welcome your calls during this hour of Focus 580 around Champaign-Urbana. If you have questions, you can call us at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here, 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, the address talk@will.uiuc.edu. We do have a listener on line number one in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I'm really glad you have this speaker on today. As a naturalized citizen, I sort of shake in my boots at the thought that I might say the wrong thing and end up in jail with no rights. I was calling mainly because I find it somewhat incongruent that we are conducting a war on terrorism, and a terrorist is someone who obviously is trying to terrorize us, and yet we conduct business at what used to be known as the School of the Americas. I think we've changed the name so that people are less likely to be defensive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we are incarcerating nuns, putting them in jail because they stand up and passively resist the continuation of this program to train terrorists against other people in this country. And I just thought I'd call. I'm going to hang up, and you can discuss that as you'd like, okay?
Okay, thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, unfortunately, it is certainly true that at least in the past, the School of the Americas has trained individuals who then went on in Latin American military context to commit very serious human rights crimes. The school will tell you that that is no longer the case and that they have a very strong human rights program, but Amnesty certainly believes that there need to be a very close scrutiny of those claims. And unfortunately, in a larger context, the United States has frequently associated itself with regimes that do commit very serious human rights crimes. And I mentioned Saudi Arabia at the outset of our broadcast. This is a country that has one of the most atrocious human rights records. Speaking of no due process, it's very difficult for those who are accused of crimes to receive legal advice. It's very difficult to rely upon any kind of independent judiciary in these cases. Some of the punishment that is meted out, including the amputation of hands and feet, is very severe. Torture is very common. And the United States has long allied itself with the Saudi government, which is obviously providing us with certain economic resources, specifically oil. And we've done so without blinking an eye. So the truth is that we have many of these alliances that would be problematic if we were to put human rights higher on our scale of considerations when we formulate our foreign policy.
You write in your book about a place in Pakistan that has been a center for protecting women from violation of their rights. And I note that in the news recently there have been a few stories about women sentenced to death by stoning. Actually, I may be confusing that with Sudan or some
place. Nigeria.
Yeah, Nigeria. That's right. That's right. But I think also it remains true that in Pakistan and indeed in Afghanistan, where we expressed a great deal of concern about the equal status of women as we discussed the Taliban regime.
Yes.
That, you know, the report seemed to indicate that very little has changed on the ground. And I wonder if there's anything that you can say about our efforts or representations of the situation of Afghanistan, if that remains part of our policy goals there. And
well, it certainly, at least officially, remains part of our policy goals in Afghanistan. And I think there is recognition, there certainly ought to be, that until women are assured of their security and integrated fully into society in Afghanistan, Afghanistan will never prosper. the reality is, if you look at economic studies around the world, you find that those countries in which women's economic resources are not taken advantage of, when women are deprived of the opportunity to gain an education or to pursue various employment options, almost inevitably, in those cases, the society remains mired in poverty and lack of development. There is a very direct connection between women's development and a society's economic and social development. And so it would be very unwise to suggest that Afghanistan will ever become a stable country without its women being promoted to full equity, as indeed they should be everywhere in the world. The larger problem in Afghanistan, unfortunately, is that not only the United States, but many of the other countries that have made economic commitments to rebuild Afghanistan have thus far failed to come through. Something like two-thirds of the promised aid that was provided, or at least was pledged to be provided immediately after the end of the war, has failed to materialize. And the country not only continues, of course, to have terrible security problems, as we saw recently with the attack on President Karzai, but it also remains still stuck, mired in tremendous poverty and lack of opportunity, even Afghan refugees flow back into the country from Pakistan and from Iran. And clearly this is an issue that we must get a hold of if we're going to make sure that Afghanistan doesn't become a haven again for terrorists.
We have several callers waiting to talk. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I sometimes feel like a broken record, but the double standard really bothers me. I mean, we are responsible, knowingly responsible, for something like 100,000 children dying of starvation and illness in Iraq. We are responsible for bombing thousands of both civilians and military in Afghanistan. We are responsible knowingly for supplying Israel with materials to kill Palestinians. This business of when they do it, it's terrorism. When we do it, it's defensive. I wish people would understand that and let it guide their actions. Please comment on that, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call.
Well, the comment I would make, certainly with regard to Iraq and Israel, as you have suggested, is that these are very good examples of how our failure to insist upon equitable enforcement of international human rights standards has, in the long run, come back to haunt us. Because while I certainly, and I think no responsible observer in any way, defends suicide bombings or in any way objects to the fact that Israel has a right to exist and must protect its borders and its citizens, nonetheless, the fact is that because the United States has failed to insist that Israel abide by international human rights standards in its treatment of the Palestinians, and because in the case of Iraq, we have indeed been the prime mover in a series of sanctions which have not punished the regime itself but punished the Iraqi citizenry, both of those things have contributed to the tremendous sense of alienation from the Arab populations of the world, and particularly in the Middle East, to the United States, against the United States. And that, as I said earlier in the program, that contributes to this support system for terrorists. I'm not suggesting by any means that all of those people in the Middle East are terrorists or even sympathetic to them, but when they see the United States failing to abide by its own standards and having, in this sense, a hypocritical record, as our caller said, that only does damage to us.
We have several callers waiting. I just can't resist following up with a question, though. All these sort of behaviors on the part of the United States vis-a-vis Israel and Iraq and elsewhere, we seem to be locked into this sort of foreign policy of standing tough, that almost, you know, sort of boxed in by our own rhetoric. And I'm wondering if you have a sense that there might be some way for a human rights constituency, if it were large enough, to shift the balance of that rhetoric in a way that says human rights values are key to resolution of these issues. I mean,
there's absolutely no question, Jack, that if we could build a large enough constituency, and this is indeed one of the major points of my book, we could begin to make a difference. We're already in some contexts able to make a difference. I'll give you a couple examples, but the larger point you're making is exactly right. The human rights movement, at least as it's formally organized, is really quite small. Amnesty International is the only international human rights organization here in the U.S. with a membership, grassroots membership base. We have 300,000 members. That's good, but if you compare it to all of the environmental organizations, for example, who have well over 1 million members, and you recognize that politicians respond to the environmental lobby far more readily than they do to the human rights lobby, if for no other reason than because of the matter of numbers, then you recognize how important it is to build a human rights constituency. And even without a widespread constituency, we've been able to have some significant impacts. One of the most dramatic recently was the Supreme Court decision outlawing the execution of the mentally retarded. And the Supreme Court based its decision on what it described as evolving community standards. And those were community standards that people who support human rights and who believe that the execution of the mentally retarded is a barbarous practice have indeed been influencing over the years. So we can make a difference, we can have an impact, but we've absolutely got to build that constituency. And I think that one way we help build it is by appealing not just to our moral senses, which is very important, and our moral imagination, which we always have done when it comes to human rights violations, but also, as I've said in this book, appealing to our own personal and national interests.
Let's talk with some more listeners. We have someone next on line number 4 in Lafayette. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. My question is this, or it's a comment with a question, I suppose. But when we were talking about prosecuting people for terrorist or alleged terrorist acts or supposed terrorist acts, it strikes me that at least what becomes fundamentally a crisis, and I think that this talks to a lot of the other parts of like how we work in the international realm, is that it seems to me there is no legal standard defining terrorism as a crime, which, you know, if you talk about something like murder or something like that, there are various gradations. There's manslaughter and all these other kinds of things. And it strikes me that unless and until we have a real set definition for the crime, that we basically make it up as we go along, and that's where the greatest danger lies. And I was hoping you might comment on that.
There is absolutely no question that there needs to be a refinement of the definition of terrorism and the codification of our laws in this respect. It is true that in many respects, crimes that are labeled terrorist crimes can be prosecuted under other statutes, statutes having to do with murder, violation of personal rights, and so on. But in the international community, you're absolutely right that there is not an agreed-upon standard definition, although within certain international covenants, for example, the one that outlaws the hijacking of aircraft, there are attempts to move towards definitions. This needs to be an important part of our future work.
Yeah. One of the things that seems to turn on is this word that we have used, the war on terrorism.
Yes.
If it's crime, then clearly statutes apply. If it's war,
right,
then it seems that the rules are less firm.
That's right. I think that quite clearly when President Bush declared a war on terrorism, he was using a metaphor, an emotional metaphor, to respond to the enormity of the crime that was committed on 9/11. This clearly is not a war in the conventional sense. It's not clear who the enemy is. It's not clear when we could declare the war over. We've quite clearly said that the people held at Guantanamo Bay are not prisoners of war, even though they were taken in the course of combat in Afghanistan. In that sense, the so-called war on terror is more like the war on poverty, for example, or the war on cancer. It is a metaphor, in a way, for military action, for a selected number of military actions, and for various kinds of criminal prosecutions, and they're all jumbled together under the label a war on terror.
We're about our midpoint with William Schultz. He's executive director of Amnesty International USA, and we're talking about the defense of human rights in the post-9/11 environment, and also drawing from his book, In Our Own Best Interest, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All, published by the Beacon Press. He will be in Champaign-Urbana this coming Thursday evening, September 19th, speaking at 7 o'clock at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana, Illinois. So if you'd like to attend that, you are free to do so. We also have several callers waiting to talk with us and at least one line open. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, the address talk@wyll.uiuc.edu. Next up, a listener in Lovington on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, my question I feel like may be extremely pessimistic, but can you cite any example of anything that the United States is doing in the world as far as foreign policy goes that doesn't, for the most part, just help our economic interest? I kind of feel like human rights talk by our government does nothing but make it a little easier for politicians to get domestic support for actions overseas.
Let me make sure I understand your question. You'd like me to cite an example of U.S. foreign policy action that is not supporting our economic interests?
Yeah, that doesn't just isn't mostly just to support our economic interests. I feel like human rights concern by our government is just mainly rhetoric to make us feel good about driving our huge SUVs, if you know what I mean.
Certainly the government is guilty of some rhetorical overblown rhetoric when it comes to human rights that is not matched by its behavior. We've already cited a number of examples. But I don't want to be quite as cynical as you may be in claiming that the U.S. has absolutely no motivation to support human rights. And I can cite a few examples. The United States has been very supportive of the war crimes tribunals in both Rwanda and in The Hague that is sitting to try Milosevic. I think it would be very hard to make the case that we have economic interests in pursuing that kind of justice. The U.S. has strongly supported the effort of the United Nations to bring the Khmer Rouge to justice in Cambodia. We have relatively modest connections economically with Cambodia, and indeed the Cambodian government has opposed the action to bring the Khmer Rouge to justice, to trial, and therefore, if anything, it would be against our economic interest to support that. The government, the United States, has also precluded U.S. companies from doing business in Burma as long as Aung San Suu Kyi, the champion of democracy there, was under house arrest. That clearly was not in the U.S.'s economic interest. We've pressed Nigeria on this case that Jack mentioned earlier, the stoning case of the young woman. The Nigerian government supplies us oil. If the Nigerian government is unhappy with the U.S. for pressing it on this stoning case of this young woman, that clearly could do us economic damage. So those are just a few examples off the top of my head, and I don't mean to deny for a minute that there are many, many other examples of where the U.S. is pursuing its own economic interest to the detriment of human rights. Perhaps China is the best example of that, where we often pull our punches when it comes to Chinese human rights violations because of our economic interest. But I wouldn't want to make quite as broad a statement as you have there.
Thanks for coming.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. I believe I heard something the other day about China and Tibet, that indeed one of the reasons that China is now even considering the return of the Dalai Lama to Tibet has been because of U.S. insistence over, and maybe not as strong as some people would like, that Tibet deserves to have some independence, if not total independence from China, at least retain its own sort of self-determination within China's borders.
Well, I think that, contrary to our last caller, that may be an optimistic view.
Okay.
I frankly would be astonished if China were to allow the Dalai Lama to return or were to allow Tibet to have greater independence. The Chinese have at least to this point been adamant in their refusal to allow that, and they have been systematically moving Chinese ethnic citizens into Tibet in order to, in effect, de-Tibetanize Tibet, and I would be surprised if they take that enlightened a view.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Comments and a question. The comment would be that a quick search for Amnesty International in the news showed a couple of stories relevant to the Anglo-American axis of good, negative stories. One was last week the State Department certified that Colombia's armed forces had met the key human rights requirements for the release of aid to the Colombian military. And it's got a quote by you, actually, Mr. Schultz, stating that to say that Colombia has complied with human rights conditions is nothing short of a farce.
That's right.
Which I appreciate. And another story that's in the UK, they have apparently laws prohibiting their arms dealers from selling arms to countries actually in conflict. So instead, they target places that are just about to go into conflict, which, of course, would make the situation even worse, such as Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. And Amnesty International is quoted there also as stating that all three countries have imprisoned, tortured, and executed Islamic fundamentalists, ethnic minority leaders, and activists. And so I thought it was, somebody should bring up the good work you're doing here. But I wanted to ask you, you were talking about getting people together to actually put pressure on decision makers, and like I subscribe to FAIR, their newsletter, and I'm wondering, I don't know, maybe Amnesty International does something similar, but they're very successful at getting the people who subscribe to their newsletter to send email to people, usually in the media, in their case, and to get them to back off on or put in retractions. They make it very easy. They send an email to you, and they give you the exact email you have to use to contact the decision maker. I'm just wondering why Amnesty International doesn't try to do the same kind of thing. They get thousands of responses to that kind of request.
Oh, indeed, and we do. I didn't mean to imply for a minute that we didn't do that. We absolutely do, and you give me the opportunity to encourage people to check our website, which is Amnesty USA, all one word, amnestyusa.org, and to click on Government Action Network, GAN, we call it GAN. And we do exactly that. We provide on a regular basis an issue. We provide a suggested communication. We provide a mechanism by which people can send emails to their elected officials and to other influential policymakers. I didn't mean to suggest we don't do that. I just meant to suggest that if we had more than 300,000 members, if we had as many members as the environmental movement, for example, we could be more effective. That's all.
Well, 300,000 emails, I would think, would...
Well, of course. If all 300,000 were to email, it would make a difference. Unfortunately, even of our membership, we don't usually get that kind of a response. But I don't mean to suggest that we aren't able to have influence. We even on some of the issues we've been discussing so far, Amnesty and other human rights organizations have had a profound impact. I mean, you notice that the military tribunals, which were announced by President Bush many months ago, have not yet been utilized. We criticize them severely. We criticize the terms under which the tribunals had been established, and those terms were significantly modified. We're still not happy with them, but they're a lot better than they were. So we indeed are able, in any number of instances, to have a significant impact on the U.S. government.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. You know, I appreciate the listener giving you an opportunity to talk about this because, you know, to a lot of people who are familiar with Amnesty International, I think it's understood the organization has long had as a sort of a key component of its strategy getting individuals to write letters and to contact people. In many cases, political prisoners have been freed You've had a lot of success in mobilizing, individual citizens to say, look, we're paying attention, we know what you're doing, and we don't approve.
That's right. Absolutely right. That's been the key to Amnesty's success since we were founded in 1961. It's been putting that human face on the victims of human rights violations so that they become more than just numbers. They become individuals with lives, with families, with hearts, with hopes, with futures, and we try to protect them. And you're right, since Amnesty was founded in 61, we have freed, we estimate conservatively, at least 40,000 prisoners of conscience, that is, people who were in prison for their nonviolent political or religious beliefs. And we continue to do that. And again, people who want to be involved in that and learn about how to be involved and be members of Amnesty, amnestyusa.org or 1-800-AMNESTY is the way to find out.
Okay. Several callers are waiting. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign County on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning. AIUSA.org is a shorter website, so you don't have to spell it all out. But I just did that, and I searched for incubators. And I was hesitating to bring this up, but I thought it might be... I'm just frustrated by all of the, what I see as disinformation and misuse of even human rights reports. Given people like James Woolsey being on the contract, working with a PR firm that gets money from the Iraqi National Congress and that kind of thing. I'm referring back to that dark day when Amnesty, and maybe it was not the Amnesty USA that joined on it, maybe it was the British Amnesty, so maybe that's why. But this is this story that was told by a supposed nurse at the congressional hearings. I think you probably know what I'm getting at.
You're
talking
about the Kuwaiti babies.
The Kuwaiti baby incubator story. So babies were being thrown out of incubators. And it said that Amnesty got on board. And it's also said, I just heard a talk by Voices in the Wilderness activists who said that, in the lead up to the Desert Storm, 7 of the House of Representative speakers, before casting their vote, mentioned that story. And it only passed by 4 votes. So I don't know if there are other records of Amnesty being duped, but that was a cook story. The daughter, the woman that spoke as a nurse, was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S., and
right.
Hill and Knowlton was helping coach her.
Right.
It was a dark day, and I just see the flood of propaganda. I did have 2 other stories in the process of searching. I found that you have a quote calling prisons incubators for psychological disturbance, and the fact that you've also called mentioned that inside the U.S., and this is another internal Amnesty project, is that torture is being institutionalized across the country in police practice. I believe that's a fair paraphrase. So I wanted you to talk about that, and your mention of Burma also brought to mind the fact that the isolation of Burma has been lessened some on the pretext of they're also fighting the war against terror, for God's sake. I mean, they were attending a certain ASEAN meeting with the U.S. where they'd formerly been blocked, if I understood correctly. But I don't know what you can actually say about the whole rush to the Desert Storm and the incubator story
sure.
at this point. But there was nothing
okay.
on the website. I expected at least a statement or something.
Well, of course, it's a 10-year-old. This is 10 years ago you're talking about. So we... let's just be clear what we're talking about here. But there's absolutely no question that Amnesty was wrong on that, and Amnesty quickly acknowledged its error in that respect, criticized the U.S. president for misusing Amnesty's reports, as indeed, I will say, President Bush just last week misused Amnesty's reports in supporting his current position with regard to Iraq, though in this case, the reports themselves, I think it's fair to say, about Iraqi human rights violations are valid and are legitimate. But there is no question that 10 years ago, Amnesty was mistaken in that respect. And all that I can say is that over 42 years, Amnesty has been correct 99.9% of the time. And in this respect, we were not correct, and we did our best to correct it. And I think people have to make a judgment as to whether that in and of itself is enough to eliminate their feeling that Amnesty is a credible or reliable source. I think that we've been proven correct so frequently that you can be pretty certain that the vast majority of the time we are. But there's no question but what, both in the Persian Gulf War and today, people will use human rights reports from Amnesty and other organizations for whatever ends they wish to pursue. And the fact is that Iraq has a horrific rights record with regard to its treatment of its own citizens. Iraqi citizens are regularly tortured and executed. We ought not to pretend that Saddam Hussein is a defender of human rights. Now, does that mean that that is an excuse for going to war? Well, certainly that's not Amnesty's position. But we can't very well monitor the way that everyone uses our reports. So we try to state the facts as we know them. With regard to your other two questions or comments, I have certainly said that there is, in my view, an unfortunate institutionalization of practices that certainly can be described as torture or at least cruel and inhumane treatment in U.S. prisons and police stations. And I was particularly referring to the growing use of electroshock equipment and of restraint chairs, which we have documented have in any number of instances been used inappropriately to inflict harm on and physical harm and pain and psychological harm on those in custody, even when there is no need to do that to control their behavior. And that is specifically what I was referring to in those references that you've made. Finally, with regard to Burma, it is true that with the release from house arrest of Aung San Suu Kyi, which took place about, I guess, 2 months ago or so, Burma is making a bid to return to a degree of respectability in the international community and certainly in the Asian, Southeast Asian or ASEAN community there. Unfortunately, the ASEAN states have not been very firm in their opposition to Burma from the very beginning. And there, it is still far too early to tell. We can all be very skeptical about whether the generals in Burma actually will allow democracy to return, will allow Aung San Suu Kyi to campaign for office and to be elected, as she probably would be, and then to take power. I'm certainly very skeptical, and you can be assured that Amnesty will be following that closely, and I suspect that our report on it will be right, whatever we end up saying.
We have just about 7 minutes left with our guest, William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. We have several callers. We'll try to get them all in. We'll have to try, ask folks to make their question as brief as they possibly can. We'll go next to a listener in Rantoul on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, a two-part question, and they're related. I was first seeing if the guest could comment on the report by the Regal, known as the Regal Report, by the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. It verified that the weapons of mass destruction that Iraq supposedly has were absolutely, you know, provided by the United States government. And then the second part is if you could make a comment about the previous ongoing and projected use of depleted uranium munitions all over the world.
Well, I'm actually, you're pretty much outside my area of expertise, certainly with regard to the second question. Amnesty does not see its job, and I think it would be presumptuous of us to suggest that we are capable of monitoring the details, the intricate scientific details of the creation of weapons of mass destruction. Our job is to report as best we can on human rights violations that we know are going on, and certainly any weapons of mass destruction that was used against civilians or in any other context would constitute a horrific human rights crime. But Amnesty is not itself monitoring those kinds of things or in a position to comment on them.
Okay. Well, let's go on and take some more questions. We've got a listener in Savoy next on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Could the guest comment on the human rights violations in Gujarat and Kashmir and what the U.S. can or has not done to ensure the fulfilling of the human rights?
Well, certainly we've seen recently in Gujarat killings there, largely of Muslims, which were encouraged, it appears, by certain officials. That, of course, Amnesty has roundly condemned. We have condemned human rights violations in Kashmir on both sides of the line of demarcation there. Certainly we've been very critical of the Indian government. In fact, interestingly enough, the Indian government is perhaps the only democratic government that does not allow Amnesty to conduct missions inside the country, and that's in large measure because the Indian government has been very unhappy with our criticisms of its behavior in Kashmir, although I have to say we've also condemned human rights violations committed by those on the side of liberation of Kashmir, as they would put it. Let me say that with regard to U.S. involvement, my personal opinion is that the U.S. Should take this issue far more seriously. It appears to have fallen to a low level of priority, despite the fact that we have these two nuclear powers facing one another. Assistant Secretary of State Armitage was there several months ago when the crisis had heated up, as it will inevitably again, and I personally would believe that we should be far more proactive than we've been in that respect.
We have one more caller waiting, and just about 2 or 3 minutes left. We'll squeeze them in. This is a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I think I visited your website several months ago. In fact, I think I lit a virtual candle for the people at the Jenin refugee camp. Did you run that?
Yes, we had a report on Jenin, yes.
And did I'm just wondering, when I did that, are there any results that you could share with us on any of this kind of action that one might take online, you know, when one visits a website and lights a virtual candle? I mean, does that actually do anything?
Well, indeed. Amnesty often, through our website, puts up individual cases of people who are in custody, who we believe are inappropriately imprisoned or who are potentially subject to torture or execution. We have between a 50 and 75% success rate in our email programs of people writing on behalf of those kinds of people. So there's no question that it makes a difference, not in every case, unfortunately, but in a good percentage of them.
And I remember it seemed the United Nations wanted to do some investigations at Jenin, but
yes.
Israeli was able to get out of it.
Yes.
I'm just wondering how we can, try to force Iraq to submit to United Nations sanctions when we let, our allies off the hook. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think that is a continuing problem. Again, this notion of not being consistent with regard to implementation of human rights standards will always come back to haunt us, and we can't allow any of our allies to violate human rights with impunity if we then expect to hold our adversaries to those same standards.
Do you have any update on Jenin that hasn't been reported in the mainstream?
No, I don't have anything more than our report that you probably referenced there.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. We just have about a minute left, I guess there are a whole lot of issues that I dare not broach because we're going to not have time to talk about them. But for those folks listening, if you would like to attend this Thursday, William Schultz, our guest, will be speaking at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana, Illinois, 7 p.m. next Thursday the 19th, and also be doing a signing of his books in our own best interest. I've been given a note that early book sales are available through email by contacting Matt Tittle, who's affiliated with the Channing Murray Foundation. His email address, Tittle3, T-I-T-T-L-E 3, at insightbb.com. And as I say, there's much more we could talk about, but maybe we could save that for another time.
Thank you, Jack. Enjoyed being with you.
Oh, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
All right.